Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Robert Harris, whose latest novel is Imperium. Earlier novels include Fatherland, Enigma, Archangel, and more recently Pompeii. And I'd like to talk a little about those books, but let's first talk about Imperium. This is about Cicero, who you describe elsewhere as the first professional politician.
Yes. Plutarch, the Greek historian, said that Cicero was the first man to think that just as a sculptor knew which tools to use if he was working in his studio, so a politician should know what tools to use, and his tools were human beings. And so Cicero learned everyone's name and learned how to get around and learned how to find where the votes were. And he was the first man really who did that, because he had to do that. He didn't have any money, he didn't have an army, he didn't have an aristocratic following. He was a self-made man.
Then it turns out, what you're saying is that the Roman Republic had been around for 200 years or so. The first politician shows up, and within 50 years, we have an empire.
Well, you could say that, or you could say, actually, that Cicero was the last desperate attempt to hold the whole show together, which I think would be a fairer analysis. There's no doubt that the Roman Republic had become incredibly sophisticated in its final years, so that the consular election, which is the climax of this novel, there were 1 million eligible voters. I mean, that's an astonishing thought for more than 2,000 years ago.
And that includes all of Italy, most of Italy?
Most of Italy, yes. I mean, most of these people would not have turned out to vote, because you had to vote in person on the field of Mars, just outside the city walls of Rome. And so mainly the voters were citizens of Rome, the city. But theoretically, 1 million people were enfranchised. And Cicero, as I describe in the book, did a campaign swing through northern Italy for about 2 months, canvassing votes.
You've wandered all over in your novels. Now, you're a journalist. You covered Tony Blair for some time.
That's true.
Are you still doing journalism work?
I do a little, but mainly now I work full-time as a novelist. But from time to time I do political journalism, yes. And I knew Blair quite well. Know him well, I suppose.
The books that you've written are set in different time periods, different eras, up until Pompeii. And I'm curious, the connection between Pompeii and Imperium. Imperium, of course, takes place over a century earlier.
After I finished Archangel, I mean, I wrote 3 books, really, almost interlinked. Fatherland, set in a Germany if Hitler had won the war. Enigma, which was about code-breaking in Bletchley Park. Archangel, which was about Stalin. And at the end of that novel, I thought that I would try something different and try and write a novel set in America, actually, in the near future. And I was going to write a novel like Fatherland, a kind of nightmare future state, loosely described as the Walt Disney Company takes over the world. So I went to Walt Disney World several times and spent a lot of time trying to make that book work. But I simply couldn't get it together. It just wouldn't cohere. And I had a nightmare day at Walt Disney World where I was in the lobby checking in, and a guy came across the lobby in a tuxedo wearing black silk Mickey Mouse ears. And with him was a woman in a white silk wedding dress wearing white silk Mickey Mouse ears. And I was told they were on their way to get married on the platform overlooking Sleeping Beauty's castle. And at that point, I realized as a novelist, I could not satirize this. There was nothing I could bring to this. So I gave up on that novel. But as luck would have it, I returned to England, and the following week, literally, there was a story in the British newspapers about new research on the destruction of Pompeii, and it suddenly occurred to me that the obvious solution for me was to transfer my preoccupations to, you know, the Roman era, and instead of a celebration Florida, to write about Pompeii and this kind of superpower, a sense of threat. And so that was how, ironically, starting off wanting to avoid writing any more historical fiction, I ended up going back thousands of years.
That book, I described it beforehand and you laughed, as Chinatown in ancient Rome. As you did your research, you discovered that water politics were at the center of a lot of Roman politics of the era.
Yes. First of all, I thought I will try and write a novel set in ancient Rome about the destruction of Pompeii. And I needed a character who would go out of Pompeii and realize that something was going wrong. And I went to Pompeii and rooted around and read that the water supply had failed 3 days before because of the volcanic expansion. It would have just broken the aqueduct. It suddenly occurred to me that that was my way in, that I could write, if you like, a Roman technological thriller, which is what I proceeded to do, and to make the central character an engineer. And it gave me a fresh take on ancient Rome. I mean, I greatly enjoyed doing that book.
And from there to Imperium.
Well, normally when I finish a novel, which has involved a lot of research, and Pompeii took about 2 years to research. I'm then quite keen to move on and do something different. My intellectual curiosity makes me want to try something else. But at the end of Pompeii, I'd enjoyed the period so much, and this double benefit, in a way, of writing about that world and trying to recreate that world of 2,000 years ago, which is very exotic, and yet at the same time use it to comment on the present. That double benefit, I was reluctant to give up, and a very good book I got an advance copy of, called Rubicon, by a writer called Tom Holland, all about the end of the Roman Republic, and I suddenly saw that these great figures, Cicero, Crassus, Caesar, Pompey, and so on, they'd all been in Rome at the same time, had all sat in the Senate at the same time, and I'd always wanted to write a political novel because, as you say, I've covered politics, and I'd been put off inventing a prime minister or president on the Mickey Mouse ears principle that I couldn't improve on the originals, I couldn't satirise the originals, and then suddenly I thought, well, why don't I transpose everything to the past and write an insider, a kind of, to use a terrible cliche, a West Wing on the Tiber, as it were, about the last days of the Roman Republic.
And what made you single out Cicero?
Cicero is a wonderful character for a novelist for a number of reasons. First of all, he's someone whose name everyone knows, but virtually no one can tell you his career, apart from him being a great speaker. Secondly, paradoxically, he is the figure, if you start to read, about whom we know the most. I mean, for instance, his correspondence, he left behind more than 800 letters.
Are there 23 volumes or something?
Yeah, there's a huge volume of material. I mean, Cicero delivered, we know, he delivered more, but we know of 106 big set-piece speeches he delivered in the Senate or the law courts. We have 58 of them. We have 14 books that he wrote. So he was both unknown to the general reader, but very well known if you started to try and research him. And when you did that, you found what a very modern character he was. He is a completely modern politician. He's exactly like a politician today. In 54 BC, he wrote a letter to a friend. He said, "Consistency has never been regarded as a virtue in a great statesman. Our language changes, but our aim remains the same." For the moment I read that, that sounded to me just exactly the description of a modern politician. He's a wonderful way of getting in and describing what it is that makes a man want to be a politician.
The entire novel is taken from the point of view of his slave, who's also his secretary, a man named Tiro. Was that just simply serendipity to discover that you had somebody there who could watch, or as you were going through the research, picking out the person, there was Tiro?
It was serendipity right at the very end, and I did 2 years of research for this book, and in the end my research file was 500,000 words long. I still wasn't sure quite how I'd use it. Essentially, I was focusing on 6 main characters, politicians, all of whom ended up dying violently, and I thought that I would have multiple points of view. But then the HBO series Rome started, and I thought, I simply don't want to write a kind of literary version of this, God help me. Then the character of Tiro really just leapt up at me. This was a man who was by Cicero's side for 30 years, who invented shorthand stenography, a system of 4,000 characters to enable him to take down Cicero's words as he uttered them, which is the reason we have so many of Cicero's speeches, who lived to be 100, according to St. Jerome, and who wrote a multi-volume life of Cicero. So I thought, well, this is a gift from the gods for a novelist. I will reconstruct his memoir of Cicero, envisaging it really as if a kind of chief of staff of a president or the press secretary of a prime minister had many years later written an account of what happened. So he was a wonderful character from my point of view.
Did you feel at all intimidated by the fact that there are so many versions of this same era, from Colleen McCulloch to Stephen Saylor to the miniseries Rome to the movie Spartacus?
No, I didn't, to be honest with you, because I think it's like shoe shops on a street, you know. It's often quite a good idea to cite your own shoe shop on the same street. I mean, writers are naturally drawn to this era from Shakespeare onwards because it's such a rich source and there's plenty of room for all of us. My stall, as it were, is quite different to anyone else's. I am trying to get inside the political processes of the Roman Republic, how the Senate operated, how you spoke in the Senate, how you won an election, how the whole thing operated. And in that sense, my take on it is completely different to everyone else's. And Cicero is a character who's been underexploited. Shakespeare in Julius Caesar only gives him 9 lines. He's been written out, really, of popular culture. He's a huge figure, of course, if you're a scholar or a long-suffering Latin student. I felt fine about that, actually.
There's one other element. We're talking about how it's a political novel, but most of the novel is actually more of a courtroom drama.
Well, the novel falls into two halves, really. I mean, Cicero made his name, like an ambitious district attorney, bringing down a corrupt Roman governor, Verres, the governor of Sicily. And the first half of the book describes how he did that, and I stick very closely to the known facts. I mean, there are the very narrations, as they're called, are an incredibly rich source for the procedure of how you took down a corrupt governor, and I follow that. That makes the first half of the book. And the second half is that Cicero parlayed that fame that he won from that case, like an ambitious DA, into a political career. And then the second half of the book describes his run for the consulship.
But he's still primarily an attorney, even while he's doing this.
Yes. Cicero's only means of advancement in politics was his voice and his brilliance as a speaker and an advocate. And he won political power by getting more and more people in his debt because he had defended them in the law courts. Every day he was in the forum in one court or another defending a client. If he won the acquittal for the client, which he often did as he was the best lawyer in town, they would then be obliged to vote for him at the next election and to get their friends and relatives too. And thus he built himself a political machine along with his brother in Rome. They completely controlled it. I mean, it was really down to neighbourhoods and precincts. You know, they could deliver the votes. Again, one is struck by how incredibly modern this is. This isn't, you know, Caesar with an army seizing power. This is modern politics.
Set against a backdrop when there seems to be virtually no police force. I mean, you walk on the street, you could be murdered.
No, there is no police force. And if you were wronged or if you felt someone was behaving badly, you launched the prosecution yourself. This is something else which I haven't really talked about before, the extraordinary way in which politics and the law in ancient Rome were intertwined. I mean, once you became a governor of a Roman province, you would very soon probably find yourself with a special prosecutor attached to you because your opponents would try and prosecute you once your term of office ended. You had immunity while you were in office, and then you were dragged in front of the courts. Well, the parallels with the American system are really striking there. The law and politics are simply two halves of the same battlefield. Again, this is the interest of Cicero to me. The Romans have become very much associated with the emperors, Nero and Augustus and so on and so forth, Caligula, Claudius. But the Republic is much more interesting when you get away from those psychos, actually.
And those few years are central to the Republic.
And it poses this enormous question for us nowadays, which is when this novel opens in 79 BC, the Roman Republic has existed for centuries. There's been civil wars and all kinds of uproar and battles and so on. But still, the essentials of the tradition have remained intact, which was the division of power and the curtailment of individual power. But by the end of the novel, within 30 years, this extraordinary democracy has completely been smashed to pieces, even though Rome is the dominant power in the world. Why should that be? That is the underlying question, which is interesting to address.
What year did you start writing in?
2003.
So this is after 9/11?
Yes, Pompeii I started before 9/11, but this I started after 9/11. Not with any kind of glib intention of drawing obvious parallels, really just because I wanted to write about politics. But as I got into it, I discovered the most striking parallel with 9/11 and the modern era that I certainly knew nothing about.
That parallel is the fleet is attacked by pirates, and suddenly all of the aristocratic party suddenly decides that they pretty much want to just take over power.
It is amazing. It's a little-known event. In 68 BC, the port of Rome, Ostia, which is about 12 or 15 miles down the Tiber, was attacked and set on fire, and a couple of leading senators who were there were kidnapped along with their staffs and bodyguards. This was not carried out by a state, because there was no state powerful enough to commit such an insult against Rome. It was carried out by pirates who deliberately spread terror. They carried out a series of, as it were, terror raids. They weren't a state. There was no treaty with them. This panic this spread in Rome was such that Pompey the Great was able to use this as a pretext to gain unprecedented power. And the old traditions of divisions of power between the consuls and annual elections and the control by the Senate of military appointments were suddenly torn up by nefarious means, actually, Pompey got himself an incredible command, which included total domination of all the land from a distance of 50 miles from the coast inland, which, of course, is most of Italy. He kept these powers. He dealt with the pirates, actually, which had been whipped up into an enormous threat. He actually dealt with them in 7 weeks after he put to sea, but he kept the powers for many years and annexed Syria and founded a great empire in the east, which was the precedent, really, for Julius Caesar doing the same in the west, in Gaul. And national security considerations began to warp the Roman state, and elections were increasingly a matter of which candidate had the most money. Pompey using the resources of the east and Caesar from the west. Between them, the elections began to become a farce, and so the whole Roman Republic began to creak and shatter. It really does go back to that raid on Ostia. I mean, there were other factors, but that, if you want to look at the turning point, that was it. And so the moral is, you know, you give up these liberties in an emergency, and you never get them back.
You're listening to an interview with Robert Harris, whose latest novel is Imperium. Robert Harris is someone who's covered politics, looking at what's happening in America today. This is very discouraging.
Well, yes, and you know, I think that one should use history sparingly, as it were, but one of the attractions and one of the points of interest about the Roman Republic is, why did it end? I mean, it was very sophisticated, it had functioned well for centuries. Is there something about being the world's only superpower that must inevitably buckle and destroy the underpinnings of your democracy? Can democracy continue to function when the sort of premises on which it was based originally, of citizen militia and the curtailment of the power of the king, suddenly you lose sight of those goals? It throws up an interesting question. I mean, America's obviously a much firmer democracy than the Roman one was, but still, you know, you can see how easily things can slip away.
Well, I talked to a historian named Gary Wills, who deals with the early days of this republic, and I said, looking at the republic today, is it in danger? And he said, look, democracy is always in danger. Not too long ago, I interviewed Alan First, who writes thrillers set during World War II. He was trying to compare Italy in the dawning days of Mussolini to what's happening now. And he said, look, you know, the way power is manipulated by potential totalitarians, it's been going on since Rome, in the same way, using the same devices.
Yes, I don't think anyone can really argue with that. I think what is alarming about what happened in Rome is the ease with which the population can be controlled and can be whipped up to a kind of war psychosis or a terrified state, and can then start to surrender liberties. And that, I think, is the great lesson that I take away from the whole thing. That and the way that money can corrupt the political process. Basically, in Rome, when Cicero started out, you could win it by the force of your oratory and argument. By the end, all that mattered was how much money you had. If you had enough money, you'd win the election.
Robert Harris, Imperium is the first of a projected trilogy, but I guess on some level you've done the research for all of them.
Yeah.
Because one giant research work.
I mean, I spent 2 years doing the research, and the research will cover all three novels, and Imperium is the first. Each of these books, you won't have to read the others, but ultimately I'd like to think that they will all fit into one whole. Pompeii, I see as my kind of hobbit, and this is my Lord of the Rings. This one takes Cicero from ambitious lawyer to the brink of power. Volume 2 will cover the power and the compromises of power and his downfall. Volume 3 covers the area which is most well known, the assassination of Caesar, the Civil War, and so on. But again, I think there's a fresh take on that one can bring by writing it from the point of view of Cicero, because Cicero did, not many people are aware of this, Cicero, after Caesar's assassination, came back and for nearly a year ran the whole empire again, even though he was 62, 63 years old. A most formidable operation, really, for a man of his age.
When you're doing all this research, how many times did that light bulb go on where you're looking at your paper earlier that day, or you're watching television or online, and suddenly you open a page in Cicero and you're going, oh my God, there it is again?
Oh, quite often. There were two particular words, actually, I came across during my research. One was pedere. There were 600 senators. The pedere were the 300 or 400 who were sort of never going to get anywhere. They were never going to be senior magistrates. from Pedius, they were the people who voted with their feet. They simply moved from one side of the chamber to the other when a division was called. And I thought that that is such a modern notion, really. I could write a book about these people. And the second word was synaculum. Synaculum means little senate, and the little senate was an area outside the senate chamber where the senators used to gather before a debate, so there would be a quorum, and that was where the real business of the republic was done. That suddenly, to me, was the senate cloakroom. That was Lyndon Johnson, really, putting together the votes, you know, making sure he got enough to get the legislation through. Again, I thought, synaculum, yes, I can envisage that. I could write about that.
Robert Harris, when you were writing Pompeii, and certainly, of course, when you were writing Fatherland and Archangel, you were a lot freer in terms of who you could invent, where you could go. And in working on Enigma and in working on this, you were more limited in that it's history as history happens. The question is, what kind of constraints did you find yourself? Did you find yourself in a straitjacket in either this book or Enigma in terms of what people did and who they were?
Straitjacket would be the negative way of putting it. A desire to try and bring alive things that actually happened is perhaps the better way of putting it. I mean, I was neurotically anxious in Enigma to stick to the timetable and to describe how actually the U-boat codes and so on were broken. And in this book, the rule I set myself was that I would not put in anything which I knew to be false. I would stick with the facts and the characters. I would obviously have to invent an enormous amount because, you know, we don't have the behind-the-scenes stuff. But I would not put anything in it which was palpably false. And I've tried to stick to that. And what I would like is, at the end of the day, to have written a trilogy of novels that will give the reader a good insight into how the Roman Republic functioned and why it collapsed and how it collapsed, to the degree that I think when eventually the books are published in a single volume, I'll even give it an index. It's the work I feel most passionate about and the one that I've enjoyed the most and the one that I think has the most value, if you like.
But still, I mean, it is fiction.
Of course it's fiction, and it requires just as much hard work as the other novels. Indeed, you could almost say more, because the way I felt when I was writing it a lot of the time, and it was a very exhilarating book to write, was like someone restoring a picture or a mosaic, that you'd got quite a lot of the tiles, and you could see quite a lot of the outline of what had been there. But your job each day was to try and fill in the gaps and the blanks to sort of bring the whole picture back to life, and that made it a really wonderful book to work on, actually, so that you would write about a Senate debate or the trial of Verus, and at the end of the day you think, oh my God, yes, it must have been something like that, and to apply your imagination to it, like you were polishing off the grime, gave me the most wonderful creative buzz, actually, more in a way than novels where I'm completely inventing everything.
Sometimes it feels, as you're talking about it, that a lot of stuff that's published these days as nonfiction may be just as fictional as Imperium.
Well, I think that there are two ways of writing about the past, and the one, of course, which is valuable, and which I completely stand on the shoulders of the scholars, absolutely, and they do the most important work. But there is a place in this process for the historical novelist who comes along and who... You know, let's take the Senate, for instance. I want to describe a Senate debate. What I want to do is see 50 or 60 faces in the Senate and put names to those faces. And I want to describe the pigeons flapping across and cooing in the open roof and the light going down and the clash and the clamour of the Senate. Now, as a novelist, I am licensed to try and bring that alive in my head and convey it to the reader in a way that a scholar, a proper historian, is not. I think that that's a function of some value. At least I hope it is.
Robert Harris, you started as a journalist?
Yes, I left university and went to work for the BBC as a trainee in the television service.
And at what point did you decide to become a fiction writer?
Well, I'd always wanted to be a writer, and I had written 4 or 5 non-fiction books. One of them was a book called Selling Hitler, which was all about the forging of Hitler's diaries. working on that, which was full of characters and it was a very strong narrative, was quite close to fiction. Among the research that I did for it was reading Hitler's table talk, his monologues in 1941 and 42 when he thought he was going to win the war, and the world, he envisaged the world as it would be after he won, and this was a revelation to me, and so I thought that I would write a non-fiction book about what the world would have been like if Hitler had won the war. I had an imaginative idea, as I thought, that I would write it as a Baedeker guide, using all the plans, the photographs of, and the models of Albert Speer's great buildings, and, you know, the Germans had 5,000 civil servants working on post-war planning. But as I worked on that book, I realized that I could not answer the central questions which interested me. If the Germans were going to have 20 million or 30 million settlers in the Ukraine, what would they have really wanted to stay there? What would it have been like? And also, how was Hitler in the post-war world going to explain away the absence of the Jews? I'm assuming that he couldn't have conquered America, he wouldn't have been powerful enough. What would America's reaction have been to him? Would they have treated him like they treated Stalin and Mao Tse-tung, as someone in the end you had to do business with? And so I went like Alice through the mirror, really. I had to start inventing, and I started inventing characters and situations, and turned into, suddenly I was a novelist, and that it was as simple as that.
But it was based on research. I mean, when you were walking through the Berlin of Fatherland, it's Albert Speer's Berlin.
Yes. I mean, always as a child, I used to, you know, make model cities or draw maps. My pleasure was inventing worlds. And most of my novels have this in common, I think, that I like to create a very detailed, imaginative world and then walk through that mirror into it.
Fatherland became a film. How did that happen? We were talking about this before the year. It's a pretty bad made-for-television film, but...
Yes, well, what happened there was that the film rights were bought by Mike Nichols, who was planning to do it with his normal studio, Columbia TriStar, and they did some research and came back and said that their target audience, you know, young people, didn't even know there'd been a war, let alone the small matter of who had won it. Also, some unease about having an SS officer, he's a detective, but all detectives were in the SS in Germany, as the central figure. So it kind of began then to dwindle from a big, you know, Hollywood budget movie to eventually an HBO movie, which again could have been absolutely fine. But it fell into that sort of limbo where everyone was pitching in. And the spirit of the book was, would the West, or specifically America, have done a deal with Adolf Hitler 20 years after the end of the war? And my answer to that, obviously, was yes. But this was considered too, I think, too strong an idea. And so in the HBO movie, when Joseph P. Kennedy, the President of the United States in 1964 in my alternative universe, is shown pictures of the Holocaust in Berlin, just as he's about to meet Hitler, he orders his car to turn around and head back to the airport. Well, first of all, that's an insult to the audience's intelligence. And secondly, it completely undercuts what I was trying to get at in the whole book. So, you know, I didn't feel too warmly towards that film, to be honest with you.
Fatherland grew out of research in a nonfiction book. Enigma was always going to be a novel then.
Enigma was always going to be a novel. Just before Fatherland was published, there was a very good documentary on the British television about Alan Turing. And as I watched it, I suddenly thought, my God, wouldn't it be interesting to have a central character who was a code breaker in the war and who saw something he wasn't supposed to see, broke a message that he wasn't supposed to read. That was the starting point. And again, it enabled me to get inside a world, to recreate a vanished world, this enormous installation at Bletchley Park, which at its peak employed 10,000 people, breaking the German codes. That was a very hard book to write. It took me 3 years. I mean, it was worth it in the end, but I never want to look at another mathematical formula again.
Did you get any response from people who were at Bletchley afterward?
Yes, I'm glad to say a very positive one. If I'd known how many people were alive of those 10,000 who would be watching for any slip, I might never have written the book. But by and large, apart from getting small details wrong, most of them liked it. It was an extraordinary time in their lives and an extraordinary institution. And I was very fortunate in that when I worked on it, I was just in time to meet some people who had had quite interesting senior jobs there. And among the people I met, actually, was Alan Turing's fiancée, who Turing was engaged to be married to, and then he told her he was gay, and she she said, well, it doesn't matter to me. And he said, well, I'm afraid it does matter to me, is what she described the conversation to me as that's how it went. And so it broke up. But she drew me sketches of the hut where they used to break the German naval codes and so on. And it was, you know, it was amazing to talk to her.
And there was a movie of that as well.
There was a movie of that, and this time a much happier experience. Tom Stoppard did the screenplay and Michael Apted directed it. It's much truer to the spirit of the book.
After that, you wrote Archangel, which takes place in Russia.
Yes.
Did you go there for the research?
I did, especially in America. Archangel was the book of mine that didn't really catch with the public in the way that the others did, and maybe for that reason is the one that I feel most warmly towards. I still think it's the best written, if I'm allowed to say that, of my books. It's basically about a Western historian, who's based on a historian I knew, actually, who is offered or is told about a notebook, which did actually exist, that Stalin kept, that vanished from his safe on the night he had a stroke. It was taken away by Beria, the chief of the secret police, and vanished. So the novel is an account of the chase to get hold of that book. And I went to Moscow and spent some time there, and then I went north to Archangel on the White Sea, where a lot of the action is set. You know, it was a wonderful time to be going, just as the communist regime was passing, and yet to see all the wreckage of it everywhere. And it was a real moment in history, and I'm glad I was there and got it.
After that came Pompeii, and all four novels, those four first novels, all to some degree or other are kind of mystery thrillers. And Imperium is not. It's a completely different kind of book.
Yes, it is. I mean, I hope it's still very readable, because my pleasure is to communicate what I find exciting and to tell stories. But it is not a thriller to the extent that it follows the traditional pattern that if only you can do this, then the world will be saved, which is a sort of true in some degree of thrillers. And Pompeii really is the book that has enabled me to turn a corner. First of all, Pompeii got me away from these sort of mid-20th century classic thriller writer territory. It also, in a way, actually, Pompeii is not a conventional thriller, because, you know, Vesuvius is going to blow up whatever the hero and the heroine and the rest of them do. I mean, and of course, the conceit of the book is the reader knows that, and it is, in a sense, like Greek tragedy, you know, where the chorus keeps coming on and saying they're all doomed, and then you watch the action. Imperium, I suppose, completes the swerve around the bend, and this is really a novel about politics.
But we also know, I mean, in Imperium, well, I guess there are people who don't know that Rome exists, but for most of us, we know that Pompey is going to do in Crassus, and Caesar is going to do in Pompey, and Brutus is going to do in Caesar, and Antony's going to do in Brutus, and, you know, down the line, Octavian will do them all in, you know?
Yes, that is certainly true, but I think that these things become myths. You can retell the story in nonfiction. We all know what happened in the Battle of Stalingrad, or we all know what happened to Adolf Hitler, or we all know about Winston Churchill or FDR, but still one wants to hear the story again, retold for a modern audience, for our time. And what I'm seeking to do in Imperium and in the novels that follow is to tell the story of the Roman Republic from a different perspective, that is, from the perspective of Cicero, and from the perspective of this world in which we now live, this world after 9/11, and this world where we are all starting to get slightly anxious about our liberties and our democracy, and whether it's going to be able to cope with the pressures and the ambitions of our rulers to take away our freedoms and our ancient rights. And that gives it, to me, the fall of the Roman Republic, an added interest.
When reading a book like this, you know, us living in times that feel similar to those times, it kind of gives us maybe insight, but also a sense of powerlessness.
Yes, I know what you mean. We are quite powerless, and I find that there is something deeply disturbing about the world in which we live now. The desire of politicians to spread terror, to go on terror, 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 terror. It's as if they want to keep us in a permanent state of nervousness and psychosis. And once they've got us in this state, they can neutralize the opposition, because if anyone dares to say, well, hold on a second, is it really as bad as all that? Of course, they're immediately dismissed as soft on terrorism, and something else is brought forth to justify yet more repressive measures or torture or whatever it is. And so, yeah, there is a sense of powerlessness, but all we can do is to look to the past and to see what happened and to try and make sure that those mistakes aren't repeated. And I think that that message can spread in all sorts of forms, and one form can be popular fiction.
Robert Harris, you know Tony Blair. What's going on in England right now?
Well, what's happening is the inevitable destruction of a political career, because, to use what has now become almost a cliche, all political careers end in failure unless cut off at midpoint, because that is the nature of politics. And Blair has gone on to the point now where he's past it, you know, and only in extreme circumstances, FDR in the Second World War, really can politicians go on for very long. People get tired and restless, and the problems have not been solved, and your words come back to haunt you. And he has, in particular, been sunk by Iraq and his relationship with George Bush. I mean, the two words, "Yo, Blair," did him an immense amount of damage. I'm afraid there's no doubt about that. It made him look like a kind of lackey, and it cost him a lot of credibility, I think, and now there is a real desire to get rid of him.
Is Bush as disliked in Britain as, say, on the continent and at both ends of this country?
I would say so, yes. And he's never really been popular in Britain, but, you know, so what? It's none of our business. But I think that there is a feeling that Britain has surrendered some of its independence of judgment and action in order to embark upon this adventure, and it's gone wrong, and it seems to have been naively undertaken and to have made the situation worse. I think that Blair is now taking a lot of blame for this, because the truth of the matter we can now see is that the place to have concentrated on was Afghanistan, and to have concentrated on this particular virulent strain of Islamic terrorism, whatever you want to call it, and not to have wandered into the Middle East and got embroiled in the whole issue of Israel and Palestine and Lebanon and Iran. And, you know, we have succeeded in widening and making worse the problem. We seem to have done exactly what Al-Qaeda would have most wished us to do. And for that reason, yeah, Blair is pretty unpopular.
As a former BBC journalist, how do you look upon the American commercial mainstream media in the world of reportage and journalism?
Well, certainly things are happening to do with embedded correspondence and that sort of thing, which I would never have expected to see in American journalism, which, you know, we retain the kind of nostalgia of the Edward R. Murrow days, however foolish that may be. And it does seem that this war in Iraq is going on, and we aren't really being given a proper picture of it, and no one would have expected that after the lessons of Vietnam. But there we are. I mean, you know, this is the whole point, I suppose, of the books that I write. This is the justification for looking at the past and seeing that nothing changes in a way.
I think when I look at what's happening in journalism, Bush is an extremist. He's been an extremist from the beginning, and yet he was put forward as being part of the moderate middle. And even now, extremist policies are being presented as if they're part of the moderate middle, including throwing out habeas corpus, torture, all of that. And I look at that, and I'm obviously just flabbergasted by it. When you're doing your research into a book like Imperium and its sequels, was there a media push, whatever media was in those days, in the same way to make extremism look normal?
I think that what there was a spreading of panic and fear that was used in the Roman Republic to justify the removal of certain ancient rights, not habeas corpus, but the right, but certain principles of the division of power and checks and balances on power. And that was removed. And then you had problems of the corruptions of overwhelming military superiority, which meant that national security considerations began to play much, much more of a part, military considerations in the domestic political process. And then there was the money that was allied with those military considerations, which meant that it became very difficult for civilian politicians to make headway against the vast amounts of money that were coming in. I mean, both Pompey the Great and Caesar had their own military lieutenants standing for office and so on and disbursing huge amounts of money. And so you had the political process which ceased to represent the people. And from there it was but a short step to the actual abandonment of the democracy. Well, you know, those are all stages on the road that one can see ahead if one wants to worst case what we've got at the moment.
There was no media per se, no...
No, there was rule by the people on the streets. But, you know, the people are susceptible to being whipped into a propaganda, whipped up by propaganda, which is what they were. And democracy is no safeguard of liberties, necessarily. I mean, one has to look at other liberties, freedom of speech and so on. And this catch-all, that if you just simply apply democracy to a state, then it will necessarily follow your line, is simply not true. I mean, Hezbollah and Hamas have had a lot of votes, but that hasn't necessarily made the situation any easier.
Robert Harris, this book is called Imperium. You have titles for the next two?
Yes, provisional titles at least. Imperium will be followed by Tumultus. A tumultus was a state of emergency as declared by the Roman Senate. And the next volume is about when the real emergencies begin to occur in the Roman Republic. And the third volume, for obvious reasons, is going to be called Dictator.
You've been listening to an interview with Robert Harris, whose latest novel is Imperium. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.